Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and we are thrilled to have you with us today. Today we're going to talk about diabetes, and we're seeing an awful lot in the press these days about diabetes and the prevalence of diabetes and the way that it's going up in this country because of our unfortunate eating habits and so forth. So we have with us today a certified diabetes educator who's going to educate us a little bit about diabetes here. And before we get going, I wanted to share with you that this program is brought to you every week as a public service by the VHL Family Alliance. We deal primarily with people with von Hippel-Lindau disease, but it's a disease that causes trouble in a number of different organ systems, and one of the many things that it can do is create diabetes, and it does that by causing tumors in the pancreas. So let me play a little bit for you about VHL, and we'll get a little orientation to that, and then we'll be back to talk with Tina Gruner. So stay tuned, and if you'd like to ask a question, you can dial in. The number is 347-237-4358, and just press 1 when you're ready to raise your hand, and we'll be glad to ask your question as well. So here's a message from the VHL Family Alliance.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, VHL, is a genetic cancer syndrome where people deal with vascular tumors of the eye, brain, spinal cord, kidney, pancreas, and adrenal glands. VHL is often misdiagnosed, but affects persons of all backgrounds and ethnicities. One person in 32,000 has VHL. Although it may seem like just one rare occurrence, people all over the world suffer from different rare diseases. In the U.S. alone, there are more than 7,000 rare diseases. Each of the rare diseases may be rare, but the experience of having a rare disease is not rare. One person in 10 is dealing with some rare disease. Together with the National Organization for Rare Disorders, VHL Family Alliance will join others around the world on February 28, 2009, to focus on rare disease challenges and the importance of research in developing safe, effective treatment. To find out more about Rare Disease Day activities and to learn how you can help support our cause, call 1-800-767-4-VHL. Again, that's 1-800-767-4-VHL. Thank you.
Or you can go to vhl.org on the internet. And even though the 2009 activities for Rare Disease Day are behind us, they will be back again next year. And in every year, on the last day of February, we talk about rare diseases. Diabetes is not a rare disease, but it certainly is an important one for all of us to keep an eye on. So I'd like to welcome Tina Gruner from Portland, Oregon. And Tina, welcome.
Thank you, Joyce. It's nice to be here.
Great. And you're with a medical practice out there, Mountain View Medical and Surgical Associates?
Yes, I am. I actually live in a very small town called Madras, and it's in central Oregon. And we have around 6,000 people in our town, but the neighboring community is larger than that, 10 to 20,000. And I see diabetics here, people with diabetes, 2 days a week, and I work in the hospital on call. But I've been very interested in diabetes. My first job, I worked with kids with type 1 diabetes at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston, and I've worked with it for 27 years. And I love helping people with it, and I have a very high interest myself. My grandfather had it, my dad has it, my sister has it. And on top of that, I have VHL, and I have tumors on my pancreas, so I'm hoping to keep myself healthy, so if I get diabetes, I'll know how to take care of it.
Great. Thank you. So we hear about type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Can you help us understand the distinction between the two?
Type 1 diabetes happens to people that all of a sudden their pancreas quits making the hormone insulin altogether. And we need insulin to push the sugar from our food into our cells so our cells can utilize it and burn it for energy. And type 1 usually happens in young kids, and there is a genetic predisposition to it, and then an environmental factor happens along the way. So they're dependent upon insulin shots to stay alive. And type 2 usually happens later on in life. The pancreas wears out and doesn't make as much insulin as it did before, and their cells become very insulin resistant, so they need more insulin than what a normal person would. These people can usually be followed with diet and exercise and some type of oral agents or pills, and they usually don't require insulin.
So in type 1, there's no insulin being produced by your body at all, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And in type 2, there may be some, but it's not enough to get the job done?
Exactly, yes.
So insulin, as you mentioned, is important for digesting sugars in particular. And when we eat sugar, sometimes we get this kind of a sugar rush. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you get really tired. So that's hooked to this insulin cycle, isn't it, somehow? Can you explain
yes.
that?
Sure. And that often happens to people when they get pre-diabetes, which is before the diabetes itself. When we eat something that is real high in simple sugar and it's absorbed rather rapidly into our bloodstream, our pancreas normally reacts by over-secreting insulin. So that drops your blood sugar level down quite rapidly, and that can actually lead to hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. And when that happens, it can actually make you hungry, so you crave more, or your liver responds by making glucose or sugar from stored glycogen or from breakdown of muscle and fat, and that can raise your blood sugar. So people with type 2 diabetes often have hypoglycemia or low blood sugar before they're actually diagnosed, and then their liver will respond by making too much sugar, so it starts a whole cycle of craving sugar, having your sugar drop, and then have your sugar go up, and it often leads to obesity.
So we need some level of sugar in our bloodstreams to have energy, right?
Yes. Normal blood sugar should be between 70 and 125, and after you eat, it can go up as high as 140. And actually, 50% of the calories that we eat should come from carbohydrate foods. And carbohydrate foods are fruit, juices, potatoes, noodles, rice, bread, desserts, cake, candy, cookies, milk. Milk actually has some carbohydrate in it. And these carbohydrates turn to sugar in our bloodstream, and some of that is good. And we really don't even tell people with diabetes they can't eat actual sugar anymore, but we do try to balance on healthy carbohydrates. But because all carbohydrates turn to sugar in your blood, we do carbohydrate counting with people with diabetes. So they have a goal of the number of grams of carbohydrate that would be good for them at each meal. And if they want to substitute a baked potato with some ice cream once in a while, they can do that and still keep their blood sugars under control.
Baked potato and ice cream. Now that's an interesting combination.
Yes, it is. But it makes it much easier, especially for kids that have diabetes. If they want to work, if they're at a birthday party and they want to work birthday cake in, they can do that by counting how many grams of carbs they're going to eat, and they can cover that with an insulin shot or to cover the sugar from what they're eating and keep their blood sugars normal.
So it's not that sugar is the enemy. It's that we need a certain amount of sugar, but we need to have it in the right proportion and in the right balance with other foods. Is that right?
Yes, it's very important to balance out your eating. One of the things that helps us keep a solid, steady state energy level in our body is to have the right combination of protein, which is found in meat, fish, chicken, dairy products, cheese, eggs, and fat, which is healthy fats, are vegetable oils, avocado, nuts, seeds, and the carbohydrate. And if you have the right balance of those, it can make your carbohydrate last longer, and it can give you the proper amount of energy, so we feel good during the day.
Mm-hmm. And exercise is part of the balance, too, isn't it?
Exercise is very important. There are 7 self-care behaviors for a healthy lifestyle that I think is important for all chronic diseases, but the American Association of Diabetes Educators came up with these 7 care behaviors. And the first one is healthy eating, which we just talked about a little bit. The second one is being active. because being active actually raises your basal metabolic rate. It builds more muscle than fat, and it helps you utilize your calories more efficiently. The third thing is monitoring. So people with diabetes can test their blood sugars. And I think people with chronic diseases have all kinds of different monitoring that they can do to make sure they're not getting into trouble. Taking medications on time is very important with diabetes. The fifth thing is problem solving, where you identify potential problems and then you take care of them. And the sixth thing is healthy coping skills, cope with the diagnosis of the disease. Most of the people that I work with that have diabetes have a large degree of denial going on because you can have diabetes and still feel really good. So healthy coping skills is important. And the last thing, number seven, is reduce the risk of complications by stop smoking if you smoke, get regular health checkups, and perform daily self-care activities. So those are the seven areas that I work on when I work with my clients that have diabetes to try to keep them healthy.
Right. Seems like the first step is getting a diagnosis of diabetes. And I heard something on the news the other day that almost half of the people who have type 2 diabetes may not even realize they have it.
Well, it's really interesting because I looked up that statistic for this show, and in America, there's about 24 million people in the United States that have diabetes, and we're getting better at diagnosing it right now, Joyce, believe it or not. We think there's at least 6 million people out there undiagnosed and maybe another 10 million that have pre-diabetes, and the reason that we're diagnosing it a lot easier now is they did a study over a 10-year time period and found out that people who have diabetes and their sugars are kept in tight control, they can reduce the many complications that come from diabetes. Mm-hmm. For example, heart disease, stroke, eye disease is one of the leading causes of blindness, kidney disease. And so doctors now have a cutoff point. If your fasting blood sugar is greater than 125, that's a diagnosis of diabetes instead of borderline diabetes. So many more people are being diagnosed now, and I really applaud the doctors for doing that.
So how do you find out, or how do you even suspect that you might have something like type 2 diabetes?
Well, the first indication would be that I tell people if you have diabetes in your family, a mother, a father, a sister, aunt, uncle, you're at high risk. And you should see your doctor regularly because of the genetic component. And they could do a blood panel every year that would include a fasting glucose, and that would tell you. But there are some symptoms of type 2 diabetes. One of the first symptoms is extreme thirst, because when your blood sugar gets high, you are getting rid of the sugar through your urine, and so you are displacing a lot of water and you get dehydrated. So people frequently are very thirsty and they urinate a lot. They could actually crave sugar, because even though their blood sugar is too high, their cells are virtually starving because they don't have the insulin to push it into their cells. So craving sugar could be part of it. Another thing that we see is people with high sugars often lose weight very rapidly. And if they're overweight, they're usually pretty excited about that, so they don't tell anybody. But when you're losing sugar in your urine, every gram of sugar that you're losing has 4 calories in it. So there is a weight loss thing that happens, unexpected weight loss. So those are the signs and symptoms we tell people to look for.
Very interesting. Yeah, let's take a little bit of a break here, and then we'll be back to talk some more. I want to follow up with you about craving sugar and how that might indicate that your cells are starving for sugar. Okay, let's hear from Keith Richards, and we'll be right back.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine, but it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
So So we're back. This is Joyce Graff, and we're back with Tina Gruner to talk about diabetes. And you mentioned something very interesting, Tina, that if you crave sugar a lot, it might indicate that your cells don't get enough sugar. Even though you're taking a lot in through your mouth, it's not getting to where it needs to be.
Yes, that can happen. And why that happens is that your brain is the most important organ in your body. And our brain needs to have its blood sugar between 70 and 125 all the time. So when you think of a bloodstream feeding the cells in your brain, and if the bloodstream is full of the sugar nutrients but it's not getting in there, the brain will send messages to different parts of your body to stimulate appetite. And that appetite is a real strong, strong feeling for you to eat more and particularly crave sugar. And what happens is when you eat more sugar and your body is digesting it, it dumps into your bloodstream and there still isn't enough insulin to push it into your cells, it makes the process of the whole thing worse.
But so it does. It does get stored as fat, and so you may be gaining weight, but your cells are actually starving?
Well, your muscle cells are actually starving when that happens, and your blood sugar in the bloodstream just keeps building up and building up and building up, and you're getting rid of it in your urine. So in the case where you don't have enough insulin, you really wouldn't be storing it as fat. Mm. Now, if you had low blood sugar because your body was over-secreting insulin, like what would happen with somebody with pre-diabetes or somebody that's just eating too much sugar, if you overeat sugar and then your pancreas over-secretes insulin, then that can dip your blood sugar down, and that also can make you very hungry. So then you would eat more sugar, and then all the extra sugar that you're eating in that, in those instances would be stored as fat.
So basically what I'm hearing is if you're having any kind of a problem with sugar, either that you like it too much or that you're getting these sugar highs and sugar lows, that you should talk with your doctor about getting tested for diabetes?
Exactly. That would be the first thing I would tell you to do. And if you get tested by your doctor and they find out your blood sugar is normal, you could always get a referral to a diabetes educator or a registered dietitian, and they could talk to you about your food plan and trying to look at the types of carbohydrates that you're eating and maybe get more of a complex carbohydrate or a high-fiber carbohydrate that it takes a little bit longer to be broken down and digested. And another thing about digestion that's kind of interesting is if you have a little bit of healthy fat with your meal, which would be the vegetable oil, the nuts, or the olive oil or avocado, then that slows down how quickly the food goes from your stomach into your intestines, and that makes your blood sugar rise slower, and that's a healthier response instead of having a real high shoot of blood sugar after a meal. So a dietitian will often tell you to include healthy fats in your meals, not overdo, but have some, and that helps with a real high rise in your blood sugar after a meal, even if you don't have diabetes.
That's interesting, and I've been seeing that lately. We went through a period in this country of saying, oh, we should have no fat, anything, and we realized we were stealing away the good fats from our bodies, and there are a certain number of good fats that our bodies really essentially need, and those good fats are in things like nuts, as you said, or some of the better oils. Fish is another good source, and what I think dark chocolate, is that one of the good sources too?
Yes, it is. The omega-3 and the omega-6 fatty acids are just imperative for health. And those are, both of those are found in the fats that you just mentioned and talked about. And when we first went on this low-fat craze, I think it was mainly due to the research that when people lost weight, their fat cells just shrunk. They didn't disappear. And when you started eating fat again, there's an enzyme that pushes the fat into your fat cells, and that enzyme was real revved up. So they thought that if you, after you had lost weight or trying to lose weight, you should cut the fat out of your diet to keep those fat cells from getting fat again. And what happened is people just replaced all their calories with sugar calories. They bought all these non-fat products that were higher in sugar because they didn't have the fat in them, and it actually made people gain more weight because their bodies just stored all that extra sugar as fat. And then the whole Mediterranean diet phase came out, where they were finding that people that had a 30 to 40% fat diet, but it was the healthy oils, actually were thinner and healthier. So the pendulum is kind of swinging back to having more fat in your diet, but making sure that it isn't the animal fat. Animal fat is called saturated fat, and that is the marbling in red meat, the little balls of fat that are underneath chicken skin, whole milk or whole dairy products. And when we eat foods that are really high in saturated animal fat, it can raise our cholesterol, and particularly the bad kind of cholesterol. So you really want to keep an eye on that. And people with diabetes often have very high levels of cholesterol. So I do spend quite a little bit of time with my clients talking to them about the difference between healthy fats and unhealthy fats.
Right, and if everybody likes a little bit of something, and after all, we're really engineered to be omnivores. That means you get to eat a little bit of everything, but it's just that you have to keep the balance right. And when we start going all the way with none of this or too much or only that, those are the really bad kinds of diets, right?
I agree. That's for sure.
I know I went through that no-fat craze for a while, but these days, if you read the labels, you'd be surprised how many of those non-fat things have things like high fructose corn syrup, because when you take the fat out, frequently you take the taste out. And in order to put some taste back, they'll put in more salt or more sugar or both to try to make it taste decent, and then your body is actually not getting any favors from this.
That is correct. And one of the things that we're finding out more is that most of the flavoring compounds in food that make food taste good are fat soluble. So things do taste better with a little bit of fat on it. For example, if you had pasta and you had a little olive oil on it, it would really bring out the flavor in the pasta and the vegetables and whatever kind of protein you had in it. The same with Chinese cooking. If you did a stir fry and you had a little bit of sesame oil on there, it really enhances the flavor. But by a little bit, we're talking about one or two teaspoons, not three or four tablespoons. And portion size has always been a problem for Americans.
Right. When you go to a restaurant in America, you probably get four times as much food as you would get in a restaurant in Europe.
Yes, that's very true. And that's a good thing to remember, is to maybe share a meal or cut your portion in half and save some of it for later.
Right. After one of my diet episodes of staying non-fat, I had very, very dry eyes. And fortunately, I went to an ophthalmologist who said to me, you know, you're going to think I'm crazy, but I'm not going to give you a medication for this. I want you every day to have at least one teaspoon of flaxseed oil.
Did it work?
It did, absolutely. And if I don't take my flaxseed oil, I feel it in my eyes. So it's really interesting. That was my first lesson in how some of these essential oils, our body absolutely requires them in order to keep things lubricated that need to be lubricated, like your eyes and like your bowels. We really have to have a certain amount of fats in order for things to work properly.
That's true. So we are now recommending that about 50% of your calories come from carbohydrate and 20% from protein and 30% from fat. And so I often help people figure out, well, how many calories do I need? And the basic person needs about 10 calories per pound of what they weigh plus what they burn for exercise during the day. So that's a real easy way of figuring out how many calories you need. And from there, we can break it down into the protein, fat, and carbohydrate. And I think that dietitians are great resources for individuals that need help with working these out. And diabetes educators are very well trained to help people with diabetes in all aspects, not just the diet part. So if you have diabetes and you're out there listening, try to get a referral to a diabetes educator from your doctor, and you won't regret it.
Right, because some of these algorithms that we're talking about on the air are pretty hard to follow or hard to figure out how that's going to get implemented in your very own life. It's really better if you can sit down with someone, as you said, and really try to work out a plan that feels good, that sounds appetizing, that sounds like something you could live with.
That is for sure. And most of my people that come to me, they're just deathly afraid I'm going to tell them to lose weight. And the most important thing for controlling your diabetes is to control your blood sugar first. So I really work very hard on people controlling their blood sugar through medication that they're working, exercise, and looking at the amount of food that they're eating. And once they start doing that, if they need to lose weight, we focus on a very small amount of weight loss, 5 or 10% of their body weight, and that improves their blood sugars dramatically. But my whole goal is never for people to just lose weight, because that's very, very hard to do. And especially the older we get, the harder it is to lose weight. And I think that there's a big fear that dietitians are going to tell you you can't eat anything, and they're just, people are afraid to go. And we like to eat just as much as anybody else. And I would never do that to somebody.
Well, yeah, and we all have to eat to live. So either we eat something that we enjoy or we eat the wrong things, and trying to figure out what is the right stuff in the right proportions is not real easy. I think with all the media attention on food, you know, turn on the television for a half an hour and you'll see at least 3 food ads. We're really led to eating what the companies would like us to eat rather than what's really good for our bodies. And we really need to, like, relearn that. You'd think, you know, monkeys left to their own devices will eat the right things. But somehow, left to our own devices, we're probably more likely to eat candy bars and junk food.
That's for sure. And a lot of it is because proper meal planning and things like that can take time. And a lot of people look at it as a chore, and they aren't taught how to do it maybe from their mom or their dad because they're busy working. They don't really learn it in school. And so fast food, stopping by a fast food restaurant or just grabbing something that's handy is the easiest thing to do. And once you get into a routine of deciding in advance, well, what am I going to have for breakfast and lunch today? What am I going to have for dinner this week? Let's make out a plan. Once you've decided it and you are working with that plan, it becomes very easy. But it's like anything, you have to start out with baby steps, and until it becomes a habit, it does take a little bit of effort.
Yeah, it certainly does. Let's take a little break, and when we come back, let's talk a little bit about family history, because you mentioned some about your own family history, and I think for other people's benefit too, we need to talk about many of the different family history clues that there might be about diabetes or other conditions as far as that goes too. I have another little message here from our sponsor, and then we'll be right back to talk some more with Tina Gruner. Please stay with us, and we'll see you in a minute.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Thanks. This is Joyce Graff. We're back talking with Tina Gruner from Oregon, who is a certified diabetes educator. And Tina, you mentioned some things about family history. What kind of clues might there be around diabetes in one's family history?
Well, there are a few ethnic groups that have a higher incidence of diabetes. So looking at what ethnicity you are is a first step. There's a higher risk in African Americans Mexican Americans, and Native America and Pima Indians. For some reason, these ethnicities and different food people groups, they have higher rates of diabetes than Caucasian Americans. And in any ethnic group, one of the big clues for type 2 diabetes would be a family that's shaped like an apple. Do you know what I mean by apple shape?
So if your body shape looks more like an apple than a pear?
Yes. Yes, that's it. If you're apple shaped like my family, we carry most of our weight between our chins and our knees. So our extremities are usually very thin and you carry weight in your trunk. Pear-shaped people carry their weight from their waist down in their legs and their rear ends. And so apple-shaped people have a higher incidence of diabetes. We're not really sure why that is, but it could be because of the fat that's in our midsection puts a lot of pressure on our inner organs. And we're finding out that our abdominal fat is an organ in itself, and it secretes all types of different hormones. And that could be another problem with diabetes. So I think looking at that, the shape of your family can be one clue. And also there are many, many different complications that go along with diabetes. The biggest complication is cardiovascular disease, and that would be heart attacks, strokes, having neuropathy or numbness in your hands and your feet, which is tingling. If anybody in your family had lots of those types of diseases and they were shaped like an apple, it could be that they had diabetes. Kidney disease, one of the leading causes of kidney failure and going on dialysis is having diabetes. High blood pressure, if people have high blood pressure, it could be that they have diabetes. Not all people with high blood pressure, of course, have diabetes, but it is a risk factor that goes along with it. So all of those types of diseases go hand in hand with diabetes. And somebody who's older might have been borderline diabetic, like what we used to call it, and the doctor never gave them a diagnosis of diabetes. But if they had all of those other risk factors going on, you can probably bet that they did have diabetes.
Interesting. Yeah, and I think it behooves all of us to know something about our family's health history, and we don't always ask, or the situation may not present itself, but there's more and more attention now, both from the Surgeon General's office and from the Genetic Alliance and from the Center for Disease Control to help people understand how to ask for this information with your family members and compile a family health tree for yourself. It's good information for you. It's good information for your doctor. It's good clues about where your issues might be. And, of course, it's very important information for your children because we all have at least one, if not four or five, potentially nasty genetic flaws. All of our cells are not perfect, and there are so many millions of cells in us, it's pretty amazing that any of us are healthy sometimes. But it's good to know what your risk factors are so that you can shape your eating, shape your habits, and so forth in a way that will enhance your health and not accidentally get you in trouble.
I think that's very good advice, Joyce, and I know that when I go to the doctor and when people come to see me, they have to fill out a patient registration form, and we do have a huge section there about are your parents still alive, if they're dead, what did they die from, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, those types of things, and many times I think that some healthcare practitioners just go through that section too fast and don't pay attention to it. But those are very, very helpful things for anybody that's in the health profession. For myself, working with diabetes, I often look to see the heart disease, the blood pressure, family history of diabetes, all of those things, and it helps me easier to come up with a food plan because they may need to watch their salt or they may need to watch their saturated fat more, or there's different types of things that they can do to help those. And personally, my mom had a brain tumor and had two unsuccessful tumors to have or surgeries to have it removed. And in retrospect, I'm very sure she had VHL. But that was back in 1967 when people didn't talk about cancer. However,
right.
my aunt on my father's side died from ovarian cancer, and I found that out right before I had to have a hysterectomy due to fibroids. And once I found that out, it helped my surgeon out a lot because he was trying to decide whether to take my ovaries or not. Because I had mm-hmm. an aunt who died of ovarian cancer, he decided right then take everything out because that's so highly genetic right there.
Right.
And so just in my family, there's probably VHL, ovarian cancer, and then I have diabetes on both sides of my family. So those are three things right there that, if I would have known most of those things a long time ago, it could have helped me. And now that I know them now, it's wonderful, but I'm 50 years old. So.
Right. So if we'd known this earlier in our lives, we might have been able to protect ourselves a little bit better from some of the worst implications of things. And I think as the younger people are coming forward, and now that we have better testing and better medical care, we can use this information to better advantage.
Exactly. And I think that it's not taboo in these days and age to talk about certain medical things. I think people are going to the doctor more frequently, and I think there's really virtually just a lot more communication about disease processes, don't you, Joyce?
Yes, I do, definitely, because, you know, in the old days, people thought it was shameful or that it was a weakness or something like that. Now we're realizing we all have these little weaknesses. Don't be ashamed of it. You just have a different collection of them than somebody else does. But we all have at least one, if not more, relatively major things that we're dealing with. And the other thing that I wanted to be sure to point out here is we're looking at family history, and you mentioned your own, where you have so many people with diabetes. Diabetes is a condition that you could have just because it's diabetes and it's a problem with the way the pancreas operates. Or, in the case of VHL, it's actually a symptom that probably is indicating that there might be a tumor in the pancreas. And it's not that the pancreas is malfunctioning. It's that there's a tumor that may be interfering with the delivery of insulin into your body.
Exactly. And one of the things that we see in VHL is not only the tumors, but the cysts. When the pancreas is loaded with the cysts, which could be pre-tumor cells or who knows what exactly they are, the cysts, when they get larger and more fluid-filled, they often will press on certain ducts and certain cells. For example, the cells that make the insulin are the beta cells or the islets of Langerhans, and they can actually be non-functional due to the number of cysts that are on somebody's pancreas. And then there are other people whose pancreases work just fine with these things. So I think having knowledge about all of that, especially if you have a disease like VHL, having the MRIs and the CT scans and things to keep an eye on those particular organs, that you could prevent, you could find out about things and prevent things from going too far. And diabetes would certainly be a serious consequence of having cysts or tumors on your pancreas.
Right. So while most of the diabetes diagnostics are chemical tests, they're blood tests or other things like that, it probably would be a good idea to have a scan along in there somewhere. Go take a look at that pancreas and just see if there's any cysts or tumors or other abnormalities that might need a different kind of attention.
I think that is a good idea. And in the hospital, I often see people who get type 1 diabetes from having pancreatitis. And pancreatitis is when the pancreas is inflamed, and it could be due to an exposure to drugs or alcohol, or you can also get it from having surgery in the hospital or having a certain type of anesthesia or dye or things like that. And so those type of people will often have CT scans and tests and various types of things besides just the blood work, so we can look at the pancreas and see what part of it is damaged. The part on your pancreas where the beta cells are in the head of your pancreas. And so that's important when doctors are looking, too, to actually see what part of the pancreas could be affected by the tumors or by the cysts.
Right. So if you've been told that you have a problem with your pancreas or with the kidney, with the function of those, and all of your tests have been blood tests and urine tests, you should probably just ask, can't we please take a picture and just check, just to rule out any other structural issues that might also be in those organs.
Yes, and CT scans are becoming more easily ready to the population. We here in Madras, our small town, we even have an MRI that's mobile, and it comes here twice a week. And we have CT scans and everything here in the hospital, and they're not scary. They're not hard to get in a CT scan that's open, so you're not enclosed, and it only takes a few minutes to get. So I just think it's wonderful technology for people to have, and it aids doctors in their diagnosis so much.
That's right. I mean, in the old days, they used to do exploratory surgery. They'd open you up and just sort of poke around and see what they could find. These days, they can get better information than that just by taking the right kind of picture. And, yes, there's a little bit of radiation, but it's about the same as you would get walking for an hour or two in the sunshine. So it's not a dangerous level of radiation, and the information that would be gained and the problems you might be able to head off are well, well worth it.
Yes, and the people with VHL that get diabetes sometimes have pancreas insufficiency, and there's other things that your pancreas does besides secrete insulin. It can secrete the digestive hormones that we need to digest our proteins, fats, and carbohydrates, and it also secretes, your pancreas secretes bicarbonate into your intestine, which changes the acid level from your stomach into more of a basic solution. So sometimes people that have type 1 diabetes or they have problems with their pancreas due to pancreatitis or VHL, they often have a larger problem than just the insulin that isn't produced. So with diabetes and different diseases, I often see that there's one, two, or three types of things that we need to work with a diet instead of just the carbohydrate. So I just urge people with diabetes to make sure that they're seeing their doctor and they're seeing a diabetes educator so they can focus on all the things that they may need to do to make themselves healthier and feel better.
Right. And you mentioned something earlier that so many people who come to you in fear that you're going to tell them to take off 10 or 20 pounds first out of the gate. And I think so many of us are worried about that with all the stuff that's in the press now about the dangers of obesity and the sort of youth culture that we have in this country. I think there's a lot of pressure on people to take off that weight. And as you say, that's not the most important message here.
No, that's not the most important message. Most of the complications that come from diabetes, and by complications from diabetes, when your blood sugar is over 180 for too long of a period of time, and too long of a period of time we're finding out might be 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. But definitely if your blood sugar is over the 180 range for 5 to 10 years, your chances of having heart disease are 50% higher. Your chances of kidney disease are much higher than that. Problems with going blind, problems with infection and poor healing in your arms and your feet and your fingers, and those areas are very high. You hear horror stories about people who, oh, my grandma had diabetes and her foot was amputated because she had a sore that didn't heal. Well, all of those things can be prevented now by keeping your blood sugar under control. And when people were diagnosed with diabetes 20 or 30 years ago, we didn't have blood glucose meters to test people's blood sugar. When I was first a dietitian in 1982 and 83, the only way we knew what people's blood sugars were to send them to a hospital and have the lab draw their blood. And then in the late 80s and early 90s, meters became available for people to actually poke a little hole in their finger and get a drop of blood and put it on a strip and stick it into the meter, and it tells you what your blood sugar is within 5 seconds. That's huge technology for the world of diabetes. And we now know that by controlling your diabetes, within tighter control, you prevent all of those, most of those complications from happening. Sure, you may get a little of one or two of those, but not complete organ failure, like what could have happened in the past. So those types of things are very easily controlled by just getting the knowledge and keeping your blood sugar in control. And to get back to your original point, I get so excited about these things, I just go off on a tangent.
You're doing you
don't have to lose the 10 pounds or the 20 pounds. Just by keeping your blood sugars under control, you can prevent those complications from happening. So if someone's resistant to losing weight or they don't know how or they're scared, it's a non-subject. I just say, I don't even want to talk about that. Let's talk about this.
Right. It's not how you look. It's not the number on the scale. It's the number on the glucose meter that really counts, right?
Exactly. And the how we look thing is it's just so sad that our society is just looking at magazines of models that are 30 pounds underweight. And, you know, People Magazine and all these other things have all these ultra-thin people with their bones sticking out because, first of all, that's not healthy, and second of all, that's not what the average American or average person looks like. So we have really unrealistic expectations for people, and we all need to be more caring and not judgmental about that. And dietitians are the first people that have to do that. And we have been taught in all of our schooling to be non-judgmental and don't focus on that. And so we make a concerted effort not to do that. And if somebody goes to a dietitian or a diabetes educator and they are judgmental about their weight, I would suggest they go and try to find a new one.
Yeah, I think the first thing to remember is you're good just the way you are. You don't have to go make major changes in your life in order to get better. What you do have to do, though, is find out what the risk factors are and how to control those risk factors and keep yourself healthier. And in this case,
exactly.
It's the invisible one is much more important than the visible one.
Yes, that is so true.
So when we do learn a little bit more about eating, it becomes a lot easier. And sometimes in the course of things, you will drop some weight just because we're keeping the blood sugar within the right parameters. But again, as you say, that's not the primary goal, and people should not be afraid that your educator is going to focus there. What they are going to do is to help you learn how to eat in a way that's going to help your body the most.
Yes, and people are usually relieved when that's what I work with them, and when they realize we're looking at the blood sugar numbers and we're looking at how many servings of carbohydrate they have at a meal, and I'm teaching them how to count that, and they usually feel 100% better. Their self-esteem goes up because they feel like they're accomplishing something. They feel more successful, and in the long run, the ones that want to lose weight do lose weight, but it's a side effect of a lot of other things, not trying to lose weight, because I do not believe in dieting. I believe in making behavioral changes. I think that dieting, when people go on a diet, it's not anything that's long-term, and that they're eventually going to gain their weight back. And what happens when we gain our weight back, if we lose it too quickly, we lose organ tissue and muscle tissue instead of fat. And then when you gain it back quickly, you're regaining back all fat. So the yo-yo dieting up and down and up and down, you're losing muscle and gaining back more fat, which is very unhealthy and very hard on our bodies.
Right. So it's much better to just focus on eating the good stuff.
Yep, and throw a little dessert in there from time to time. I don't believe in forbidden foods. I think the more forbidden things are, the more we're going to crave it and we're going to want it. And so if you tell yourself, yes, if I want to have chocolate cake, I could have it every day, but maybe I should start with a 2-inch piece instead of a 5-inch piece and look at it that way, that it doesn't have to be total abstinence. It's watching the portion size and having it in smaller amounts when you want it, instead of putting it off and putting it off and putting it off and then binging on it.
Right. So no forbidden foods, but just everything in the right proportion.
Right.
Right. We have one question that's coming in on the chat line here. So of the causes of diabetes, there are sometimes adult onset type 1 diabetes. Could be from a virus, a cold, something that disrupts the pancreas. Can you tell us about things like that?
That's an excellent question. I do see adults sometimes that get type 1 diabetes. And we know that with diabetes, there's a genetic proponent that you get that you inherit the risk for diabetes that, through your genetic makeup. And then there's an environmental trigger. And one of the triggers that they think causes type 1 diabetes is a virus or some illness. And what happens is the virus could settle or attack the pancreas, and it becomes an autoimmune disorder where the change in the DNA in your system due to the virus attack makes you become almost allergic to yourself, and your body kills the islets of Langerhans or the beta cells that make the insulin. So in type 1 diabetes that's brought on by an environmental insult like a virus, then you actually do become allergic to that part of your body, and your body actually kills that part. And that's why type 1 diabetes is one of the autoimmune disorders like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis.
Where the body basically attacks its own pancreas.
Mm-hmm.
Wild.
Isn't that wild?
It is. It's amazing. But our bodies are pretty incredible machines, aren't they?
I am amazed at the human body. It just, we have so many systems that just run seamlessly most of the time, and there's biofeedback systems, just appetite. There's many, many things that stimulate that. Your blood cell sugar stimulates it, your blood stream sugar, your the amount of fat in your diet, the fullness, the satiety of your stomach. You have baroreceptors that stretch out when your stomach is stretched out. Your hydration status, meaning if you're dehydrated and you get thirsty, you can also be hungry. There's so many different things that affect your appetite, and they're all feedback systems that tie into it. And your pancreas and your liver and your brain, they all work hand in hand to control your blood sugar. And your adrenal glands play a big part in blood sugar, too. And that's something that we didn't talk about, but when you're under stress, your adrenal glands make more adrenaline and more norepinephrine and more cortisol, which is a natural steroid, and that tells your body that you're going to deal with some kind of fight or flight, and that causes your liver to make more sugar to provide energy to the situation. So stress can make people's blood sugar go up. And when people are in the hospital, their blood sugars are often artificially elevated due to stress.
Interesting. So stress can make your blood sugar go up, not just make your appetite go up, but just make your blood sugar go up.
Yes.
Huh.
It can do both. So when people are under stress, they can often be hungrier, and it can make their blood sugar go up. And there's been a lot of studies that when you're under stress and your adrenal glands are pumping out all of that when you eat, it signals the brain that you killed the animal that was chasing you, and it calms you down.
Yeah, we're really, you know, because we were designed back in the Stone Age, really.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so get that saber-toothed tiger if he doesn't get you
hurt. Exactly.
Yeah, interesting. So we've got about 10 minutes left, no, 6 minutes left here, and so we should start winding down. What are the most important messages to take away? I know the prominent message that I keep coming back to for people with VHL, because we don't have a cure, so we have to do what we can to try to minimize the effects of disease. And the three basics are eat a healthy diet, which we've been talking about, get plenty of sleep so your body has a chance to repair itself, and manage your stress. And I think I've heard echoes of that in our conversation today.
Yes, those three things are very important for any chronic disease, especially people with VHL. There's many things about VHL and diabetes that go hand in hand. You need to have healthy eating. You need to monitor what's going on. You need to take your medications if you're on medications. Like I had a bilateral adrenalectomy, so I'm on cortisone and Florinef, and I have to take those. I have to take my cortisone every 12 hours, or I could seriously, I could die, just like a diabetic that's dependent on insulin needs their insulin, or they could die. The problem-solving techniques, a diabetic needs to be prepared for going to parties, visiting friends, being out. People with VHL need to have problem-solving techniques also. Healthy coping skills, like you were talking about with stress. People with diabetes, if they let the stress get out of hand, it can make their blood sugars go sky high. And with VHL, we have to have healthy coping skills too. And reducing risk of complications. Take care of yourself. Get your health checkups. Get your scans. Get your blood work done. Stay on top of things. Take care of things before small problems become huge problems.
That's really great advice. And for those of you who are scribbling fast to take notes, we will put this in the handout that goes with this show. So if you go to powerfulpatient.org, you will find the notes from this show that you can print out from the Internet with the seven care behaviors that Tina talked about earlier and some references to places on the web that you can go for additional information. And hopefully, if you do have diabetes, please hook up with a diabetes educator. You've heard from a wonderful one today. Thanks, Tina, for being with us. And hopefully you'll get the help that you need to stay on top of your condition and be healthier. So guidelines for being a powerful patient, right?
Exactly. Thank you, Joyce, for having me.
Any other words of wisdom you want to leave with people?
I just want to say thank you so much to the VHL Alliance Center and to you, Joyce. You have inspired so many people and helped so many people wander through the murky haze of having a chronic disease. And you're my angel. What can I say? Thank you.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. So thanks. It's been wonderful to have Tina with us today. And next week we're going to have a very interesting conversation with Reg Green. He's written a book about his son who, at 7 years old, he and his wife and his seven-year-old son were on vacation in Italy. They were held up on the highway, and his son was murdered. While he was dying in the hospital, the parents authorized them to transplant his organs into seven different people in Italy who are alive today and healthier because of the gifts of their son. He has been declared a national hero in Italy, and he actually changed the law in Italy. So you're going to get to hear about the world's most famous organ donor next week. It should be a wonderful conversation with Reg Green, and we hope that you'll be able to join us. So the most important message we want to leave with you is you are the person who is most in control of your health. And in order to really do your best job with that, you need information. So you need to go to your doctor, get the information, understand your risk factors, and then act on those to optimize your health. And we hope that you will be well and be a powerful patient. Thanks so much, and we'll see you again next week.